Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And today we're back with more theory.
Hey. Yeah, we're bringing our theory into the laboratory setting to focus on some of the routine coagulation testing. Yeah. So when you think routine coag testing, because this can kind of be a little bit variable and it's changed throughout the years a little bit too, right? I think PT, PTT are like the mainstay. And then fibrinogens right there. And I guess some of the newer, or maybe not newer assays, but certainly higher throughput would probably be the D-dimer. And then just in this moment, I'm thinking about the anti-10A.
So I also think about the anti-10A, but I think that's because of where we come from.
Yeah,
So, like
maybe.
the institution Dave and I worked at, anti-10A was routine for heparin and the hybrid curve heparin. And then when you talked about like anti-10As for the DOACs, that was more of a specialty sort of thing. But the moving to a much more rural in location now where I live, anti-10As are not routine.
Fair enough.
So
So
I think
yeah,
it
maybe that would be
depends.
more appropriate with some of the more special testing. Cool. All right, less stuff to talk about. Jeez. All right, so like alphabetical, I guess. A P T T.
Yes, so A P T T, not A P P T. I only say that because I can't tell you the number of times I've seen students call it the A P P T, and it's the A P
That's
T T.
really funny. I feel semi self-conscious as if like I might have made that that speaking mistake. I don't think I would make the writing mistake, but that's funny.
No. I have also seen the writing mistake, but
Fair
it's the
enough.
APTT, the activated partial thromboplastin time.
Yes. So APTT is invaluable for assessing the intrinsic cascade. So referencing our previous lecture, we talked about intrinsic-extrinsic coagulation. The APTT is going to be using the intrinsic and common pathway to form a clot. So,
And I
cool.
think
So,
too, like we won't touch on like the pre-analytical considerations because we did that with LaShonta, with Dr. Bryce on a previous episode. So if you're interested in also learning like the pre-analytical things to think about before you draw routine or special tests, make sure you listen to the episode with Dr. Bryce because she talks about a lot of the considerations and one of the things, one of the really big things that I think she brought up, because we're talking about interpretation a little bit, with the APTT measuring the intrinsic and common pathways, as physicians or the care providers think about coag slightly differently. They don't think about it in the same pathway ways that we think about it. So keep that in mind as we're thinking about it, because if you're actually working in the lab and working with physicians, it's a slightly different conversation.
Yeah, for Melissa and I, it's all about that cuvette, what's happening in the cuvette. So I guess there's different ways to kind of approach thinking about the testing, but I like to look at the reagents a little bit. I think thinking about the reagents can be sort of helpful, and also kind of ties back. I personally like it because as like a learner, I think it ties back to some of the most important pieces to coag.
Absolutely.
So I'm gonna be honest. I wish I had a package insert. I went and started down a path and to be a little bit unprepared. But yeah. So the APTT is typically set up in kind of stages, right? So, I'm going to try to mention it each time we talk about a test, but for most of these tests, these are done at a particular temperature, right? So controlling the temperature of the reaction is critical for having consistent reactions. So if the sample is cold, it's not going to clot as fast. If it's overheated, I guess there's different issues we can run into there, right? That would presumably speed up the reaction and perhaps degrade some of the proteins and denature them. So I think like typically analyzers have like a pretty tight temperature control, somewhere around what is it, body temp, I think. I kind of forget. Temperature is a big consideration. So typically, I think most analyzers, auto analyzers, or if it's being set up manually, we would incubate patient plasma and the APTT reagents, which contains, I believe, like phospholipid and
Well, phospholipid is the major component. And if you think about the APTT, and actually I'll what this is where I'll bring up a whiteboard. If you think about the APTT, makes sense, right? That we would need to have an extra phospholipid because we have to get through two of the pathways.
So setting up the intrinsic cascade, we had, high molecular weight kininogen, prekallikrein, we had those funny things, right? 12, activating 11. But eventually we get to what we've called the intrinsic 10ase. And so in that lecture, when we talked about the intrinsic 10ase, we have factors 8 and 9. Critical components there were calcium and phospholipid. And so typically in clotting, phospholipid is coming from activated platelets. So because of the way the samples are prepared, there should be no platelets in the sample that's aliquoted for testing. So it needs to be provided from an exogenous source. And in this case, it's this particular reagent. So APTT typically has two reagents. So thank you for drawing out the cascade there. So our first PTT reagent is going to supply that phospholipid. And so we have phospholipid reagent with patient plasma incubating at temperature for a period of time. So this is pretty much standardized in analyzers. And the idea is to get the sample to warm to a stable temperature.
And to allow the patient plasma to mix with the phospholipid.
Absolutely, right. So like all the dynamics of how that goes. So then the interval of time there may vary, I don't know, depending on analyzers and things. But after adequate time of incubation, where the analyzer or the technologist is going to add calcium. So this is a critical starter reagent. So as soon as that calcium hits that cuvette, the reaction and coag stuff starts. And so it is typically at this point that the analyzer will start its own internal timer, right? Eventually, we'll work through this cool cascade. We'll end up with a fibrinogen converted to fibrin, and a stable clot will form. I'll say we have different
Well,
methodologies. Ooh.
stable, it'll just be a clot that
A clot,
forms.
fair
And
enough.
we won't know because as soon as clot formation happens, it'll stop measuring. So I only drew through fibrin monomers because when you get to, with our routine test, it stops right as soon as the clot forms. So we don't know if it's a stable clot. So we never see the activity of factor 13 activated. So I didn't draw that one in here because these are all the factors that are going to be impact or that will impact the APTT.
That was definitely a misspeaking on my part. A deficiency in factor 13 is never going to be evident in either the APTT or the PT. So there's an important distinction. So I use the term stabilized clot incorrectly. So we will have clot formation. Now, determining that endpoint, there's two different methodologies that we've encountered. I don't know if there's more. But there's typically some sort of a mechanical clot detection, which is kind of neat. And so from what I've seen with these methodologies, they're using magnets and a metal bearing that will kind of just swish back and forth in the solution. And then once we get those fibrin strands forming, it's going to arrest the metal bearing. And that's that once the metal bearing stops moving, that's how the analyzer knows, hey, there has to be a clot here, right? Liquid has become solid, stops the ball, there's a clot. So really, really cool methodology, typically employed by Stago. And then there is also an optical method, right? So for the optical method, the entire time the reaction's taking place, we have a light source and a light path monitoring system of some kind, right? Where it's detecting absorbance. And when the clot forms, the absorbance on the receiving end changes because now you have this opacity, right? These solid, vibrant strands that show up. And there are a lot of complicated maths. I don't know that this is the place to kind of go over
No.
those. I'm certainly not prepared. But yeah, there are complicated maths for both the APTT and PT and
We
with regard to.
yeah, so it's measuring maximum amplitude and slash or maximum velocity, and both are measured for the APTT, but we're not going into either of those.
So there's a lot to these, and so the neat part about the optical method is you do have this clot signature curve, this data curve that's drawn out that can really help you in kind of doing some of the interpretation. It's kind of nice. So both methods kind of have good things and some things, some bad things. So like the optical methods typically have color interferences and things like that that can kind of come up, lipemia. Is a big one. Whereas like the mechanical detection doesn't have those same limitations as much, right? So
No, but low fibrinogens or fragile fibrinogens can easily be broken up by the mechanical method. So it depends, both have pros and cons, and it in part it depends on the patient population with me which methodology is going to be better. And so that's a different story for a different
and
time.
for our laboratory, the best was both. So, having a secondary method that's complementary and different is pretty nice. And not that I cared to take out the manual analyzer when I needed it, but you know, like
Listen,
in hindsight,
listen. All
I
right.
it's funny.
The worst was when we had a routine, automated coag analyzer, and then we had the special coagulation automated analyzer that could do routine testing, and both of them went down. And then we had to pull out those little mechanical tabletop ones and manually perform PT and APTT tests. That's happened to me twice.
The hardest part about that, I would imagine, is the organization of everything, right? And making sure that that part is really, really critical. We take for granted the positive identification barcodes, and oh my
And
goodness, this,
automatically sending the results. Oh yeah, no.
super
It's a
helpful.
t it's a yeah. It was a terrible, that's a different story for a different day. But those were best on bad days.
So I
Yeah.
think we described an APTT.
Yeah. Yep. So just for completeness, it's again our intrinsic factors 12, 11, 9, and 8. And then, of course, high molecular weight kininogen and prekallikrein will also impact the APTT. And then we also have our common pathway factors. So we have 10, 5, 2, and 1 that we're measuring with the APTT.
Cool.
That's it for
As far as
APTT.
reference ranges and stuff like that, that should be kind of determined at the but mid 30 seconds ish, right?
Okay, so we'll get rid of this and move on to the PT.
And maybe we should get rid of it. Yeah. It's a shame we did all that cool drawing. We don't want to confuse people though, I guess. So we have the PT. PT standing for prothrombin time, right? So prothrombin time is going to be somewhat similar, one less reagent, which is cool, I guess, especially when you're doing the manual test. So in a similar fashion, we're going to have patient sample aliquoted and coming to temperature. That's critical. I should also add that some of these analyzers have like temperature control probes and like temperature control reagent bays and all sorts of like, it's really cool stuff. Anywho, so we have patient sample incubating in a cuvette, and then we have the prothrombin reagent. So prothrombin reagent, if I remember correctly, contains phospholipid, calcium, and tissue factor. Is that accurate, Melissa? I think. Yeah. So, and if we remember, the extrinsic pathway starts with tissue factor 7A as our extrinsic tenase. So this will be acting and activating a lot of factor 10. So one thing we can kind of see when you draw this out is that there are less intermediate steps, right? And so as a consequence of there being less steps and just the way the reactions kind of go, PTs tend to be shorter than the APTT in time. But very similar, we have as soon as the PT reagent hits the cuvette, that calcium, phospholipid, and tissue factor is going to immediately go to work. So that is when the analyzer will start, I should say, its internal clock. And then once we have fibrin monomers present, we will the analyzer will stop. And again, depending on mechanical or optical, will determine that endpoint there.
I think the other thing that's really important when we talk about the PT is the INR.
Yikes, right? So one of the I guess I've lost a sense as to what the predominant anticoagulant, outpatient kind of anticoagulant of choice is. But historically, it was Coumadin or warfarin, depending on.
Warfarin,
So with the way that these anticoagulants work is to act as a vitamin K antagonist. And so without vitamin K, there's a critical step in vitamin K dependent factors that stops them from becoming,
active.
active and able to participate in coagulation, right? So by limiting, so it's complicated because this chemical is going to work to prevent, vitamin K from getting in the mix. The complicated part of this is that the person's diet should remain somewhat static, right? So there are certain foods that are rich in vitamin K. And so there's a delicate balance of like the leafy greens and then the dosage. And so the Coumadin requires kind of a constant monitoring, right? And so variability between laboratories on the PT was just present based on reagents and the different systems that were involved here. So there was a need for some kind of a standardization. And so the INR was developed, the International Normalized Ratio. Is that the? So the INR is calculated based off of the patient's PT time, the mean PT time. So this would be for determined with the was it the average population, I suppose. I kind of disconnected from where these variables come
Yeah,
from.
so the mean PT is coming from the institution's population, normal population, and you're using that particular lot of the PT reagent because the ISI value comes from the lot of the PT reagent. So the mean PT is going to change, and the ISI, well, may change, not always, because sometimes the ISI value is the same and sometimes reagents are really similar, but the mean PT has to be established each time there's a new lot of PT, and then you take the ISI value from whatever the lot is of the PT reagent that you're using. So the patient PT obviously will change with the patient, but the mean PT and the ISI value will help to standardize the INR or the PT so that physicians can use it to interpret for warfarin therapy.
The ISI provided by the manufacturer and the package insert. In my experience, I've been seeing a lot of these be 1.0. So I think the the need for the INR to come about, and then that has put pressure on manufacturers to, they seem to have sort of normalized the way that they make these reagents. But in any event, the INR is a result that's reported alongside the PT in pretty much every system I've seen. And in the instance of Coumadin anticoagulant therapies, that is the where they're going to achieve a therapeutic range, so to speak, which can be variable based on the patient. Sometimes it's 2 to 3, sometimes it's 2.5 to 3.5.
And it depends on the service that the patient's on.
Right.
So
So,
cardiac, neurology, that sort of thing.
yeah. So, and basically amounting to different goals for the anticoagulation therapy. So they have different ranges that they're adhering to. But in any event, the INR is very, very important there. Yeah, so.
You know what's interesting is the INR is really supposed to only be used for monitoring warfarin therapy. Like, that's the
Yeah.
use of the INR. But I've seen institutions that don't report the PT and only report the INR.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's ludicrous.
It is. It's still crazy to me. Yeah.
So it's possible to like intuitively reverse engineer what the PT is aboutish, but that's crazy. I don't understand why they would even think that that was wise, but
I don't understand either, but I thought I'd share the
not
craziness.
I'm not a lab director, right? So I think that does the
Think that's
PT?
the PT. So we've
Yeah.
done the, so we did the PT and the APTT, and now we can move on to the fibrinogen.
Yeah, I guess one note is that like so you have the intrinsic cascade and common pathway, you have the extrinsic cascade and common pathway. So in evaluating those results, you typically see PTs and PTTs ordered together. They work great together, right? They're both prolonged. We might think in the common pathway, right? If you have one prolonged and one not, then it may intuit that the it's either the intrinsic or extrinsic cascade. So cool.
And then the fibrinogen.
Fibrinogen. So fibrinogen is a funny one because it's reported as a concentration, right? So we're looking at unit mass of fibrinogen per unit volume.
Yeah, I think it's
So
typically milligrams per deciliter is
yeah.
the typical reporting, but it'll
You
vary.
could see that I didn't want to like go out on a limb here. This is all coming out of
It's all good.
but yeah, so yeah, so we have this concentration that's being reported, and but it's still a clotting assay. So what the
Yes.
analyzer is going to measure is clotting time again
Yes.
from reagent to the endpoint. And then it takes that and sort of says there must be this roughly this amount of fibrinogen present.
Compared to a calibration curve.
Exactly. Yep. So we're using a calibration standard. Yep. So and I believe it's the is that the Krauss method?
Klaus, yeah.
Klaus.
You were
Yeah.
close.
Oh well. Could have let her
Yeah, there's
wrong.
Klaus, there's the modified Klaus. So there's a couple of different ones. Essentially, you're adding thrombin
Yep.
and you're
Yep.
just measuring the patient's fibrinogen.
Yep. So it's a really beautiful assay, honestly, in how simple it is. So just to bring it back, right? So in the common pathway, we have factor two known as prothrombin. And so this test utilizes 2A, which is our thrombin. So fully activated, usually comes from so in the platform we used is bovine, came from it's like
Yeah.
a kind of like animal
A lot of
source of
things are bovine, the one we
Yeah.
use.
Yeah. So you have this bovine thrombin, you introduce it into the patient's sample, and presumably they have X fibrinogen. And yeah, I think also in the reagent is calcium, if I'm not mistaken. I think they provide
Think
that
so.
too. Yeah.
But the thrombin is the
Yeah,
big thing.
it might actually just be thrombin. Yeah, I'm just but yeah, thrombin is absolutely the thing. So what's neat is there's no little to no variable here in the equation, and that's what allows that mathematical kind of like, well, this is the concentration. The math is all behind Curtain, I don't know
No.
it. But yeah, standard curves and stuff,
But
right?
again, if it's clot based, you could be using either methodology for establishing the curves or the patient samples. And that differs from the D-dimer because that is not a clot-based assay.
So this one is weird. So we went through three normal coags that are coag based, they're clot based assays. D-dimer, not so much, right? So every platform I've used has been an immunoassay, turbidimetry. Geez, we should have like a chemistry person on or something to talk about.
I teach chemistry. Watch out.
There you go. You're more than qualified. So yeah, if I remember correctly, it's latex beads, antibody bound to surface with targets for the D-dimer.
Yeah, and remember DD. It's the two
Yes.
D domains together. So
Right.
when you get fibrin breakdown in general, you could get D domains, E domains, DE domains, ED domains, but in order to get D and D together, you have to have factor 13 creating those covalent bonds between fibrin monomers to create fibrin polymers. So the D-dimer assay is looking specifically for the D-dimer domain so that the two D is bound together. So it's the D-dimer assay is specific for clot formation and clot breakdown. And the significance of the D-dimer assay is the negative predictive value.
Yeah, 100%, which is kind of funny, right? So a lot of times it's about saying what something is. The D-dimer can't do that, but
Because
it
if you have a
does.
positive D-dimer, it just means there's clots forming and breaking down. But is that, like, did the patient just go through surgery? If so, then that should be happening to fix and, come back from the surgery. So remember, this coagulation is a normal process. So the D-dimer is going to show us, yes, there are D-dimers if coagulation is happening normally versus abnormally. But the real value is saying no, coagulation isn't happening so that you can rule out clot formation. So you can rule out stroke or whatever it is. You're ruling out thrombosis.
So yeah, just to expand on that, well, to dig specifically into that, if on the differential diagnoses, if on the rule out lists, the clinician is worried about thromboses, which could be defined as inappropriate clot formation, right? So thrombosis, always bad, always pathological. So in that case, the D-dimer has, if the result is in the lower side stated in the negative predictive range, right, then they can say with high confidence that there is likely not thrombosis. So that's the major significance for D-dimer. I think you see it over-ordered, sort of, probably. We'd have OR patients and they just order the whole thing. And I can't pretend to be a medical doctor, I won't, but it seems to me like, why'd you do that? It's like always to some degree positive, right?
So
I mean,
unfortunately, physicians don't understand coag as well as they should. Coag testing, I mean lab testing in general for the most part, but really coag testing, they just order it and they're like, yeah, I've actually had times where I've been in special coag and I've called doctors and I said, why did you order this? And they just said I liked the name. And I was like, no, that's not happening. Like you can't order something just because you like the name. So unfortunately, I don't think they know. So they just order whatever. And then they're looking for H's and L's, the high and the low symbols that they can see. And then if they see that, they're like, aha, I don't know what it is, but ha.
And in this case, it's really not super helpful. And this test tends to be on the expensive side, sort of, because of the materials. Coating latex bead with antibody is
Typically more
expensive.
expensive than like a clot-based assay.
Yeah, than having some calcium and rabbit brain or something, right, in a tube. So anything else we can add about the D-dimer?
No, I think that's the big thing, the
Cool.
negative predictive value.
So those are routine coagulation testing. Taken together, they can tell you a lot about what's going on. So like I think of all four tests and thinking about like DIC and things like that, a very valuable panel of tests. And I feel like every ED patient should get the PT/PTT. That's just like my cool.
Yeah, and I think the rest of the assays we'll cover at some point. Like we were saying in the beginning, the anti-10A assay sometimes is a routine assay for heparin monitoring, and sometimes it's not. So it just depends on the institution, but we'll cover that eventually because that is an important assay to cover.
Absolutely. Agreed.
All right, well, I think that's all we've got for this episode. So thanks for watching.
Thank you for your time.